from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
You never know when history is about to happen. I always tell my students, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, watch out. Because history is happening all around you.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Fred Yanaga, our first guest on today's program. Dr. Yanaga is chairman and associate professor of German at Hillsdale College. He also was in Germany when the fall of the Berlin Wall began, November 9th, 1989. What an amazing time in history to be present for. What was that experience like? Why were you there in the first place?
Right. Scott, I was spending my junior year abroad in Germany. I was in college. I was 20 years old, and I was studying German and international studies, and it was time for me to go spend some time overseas and to see the world a little bit. And so I spent a year in Heidelberg, and that was in the western part of divided Germany at the time, and it was the fall of 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an amazing time. Historically, you never know when history is about to happen. I always tell my students, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, watch out, because history is happening all around you. And the timing was perfect for me. I was there right in the middle of it.
So can you remember the feeling leading up to, I would say that day, but that, you know, that those days when the wall literally came
right
down? Was there a feeling that this was going to happen? Was there this sense that a great event was going to occur?
Of course, looking back today, all of the signs were leading up to big changes. But at the time, no one would have ever believed it. The late summer of 1989 was full of political changes, of social movements. You could feel the stress in the air. I was living in a dormitory with 50 men, and we had breakfast every morning together. We would read the newspapers. We would talk about what was happening, and we would see things happening. The Hungarians were opening the border. There was a flood of immigrants across that open border already in August, September of 1989. The embassy in Prague, the West German embassy in Prague, was being invaded by East German tourists who were climbing the fence and then taking up refuge on the grounds of the West German embassy in Prague. And then they were being sent by train to West Germany after that. So there were obvious signs that things were happening. There were big demonstrations in East Germany at the time. They had what they called the Montagsspaziergänge, and they would walk and protesting silently, often protesting peacefully for change in the GDR in East Germany. And nonetheless, never would anyone have anticipated the kind of change, the fall of the Berlin Wall on the 9th of November.
Before the wall came down, did you talk to people around you about what life was like on the other side of that wall?
Yes, and I had actually been to East Germany. I had been an exchange student in high school, and I had traveled to East Berlin, and I had traveled to Weimar, which is the cultural capital of East Germany and of all of Germany, actually, where Goethe lived and wrote. And I had seen it with my own eyes. I knew what was happening there. I had seen the border frontier. I had seen the wall in Berlin. And I had thought, this is the status quo. This is the way it has been. This is the way it will always be. I couldn't imagine that it would change.
What did the breaking down of that wall mean for local Germans?
Well, on both sides of the wall, there were big changes, and they were radical and they were fast. So, and thankfully, they were done peacefully. That was the most important thing. So I was a college student, a university student in Heidelberg, and immediately after that, after the wall fell, there were people coming from the east. They had freedom of travel for the first time, and so many people just left very quickly, especially young people. And so we saw them showing up at the university. We saw them showing up in the workplace. I was working a job in a hotel, and I had some East German coworkers then quickly. What happened in East Germany, though, quickly was that because the economy was so false, it was an artificial economy.
Sure.
A lot of things broke down quickly. So a lot of jobs were lost. There was high unemployment pretty quickly. And the West needed to step in to really stabilize that economy and help things along. Even today, it's not quite equal. So even these many years later, these 30 years later, they still haven't reached complete parity between the East and the West.
Maybe jumping the gun a bit, but
you know, after the fact, was there discussion, was there talk of unification, which of course eventually, which eventually happened. What was that? Was that on the minds
there was
of people?
There was immediate talk of unification because there had always been unification ideas behind the political movings in the West. So the West German constitution that was set up simply took for granted that the two Germanys would be united one day. That constitution was written in 1949. So we just celebrated 70 years of that constitution. And that's actually the constitution that's in place for Germany today. And so from the very beginning, there was talk about reunifying the country. Thankfully, there was good cooperation from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There was tolerance from Great Britain, although not immediately, and from France. Of course, there was some suspicion mm-hmm. what's going to happen. And the Russians, Gorbachev also played well with others in this. And, you know, it's really a great example of a peaceful revolution in our times that was successful. There was no bloodshed. And the result has been fantastic. Right, Germany has grown to become an economic, political power in Europe, and really a unifying power in Europe. And I think for the good, for peace, and you know, the state of the East German economy has grown. The relationship of Germany to countries in the East, Poland, further east, the growth of the European Union, you know, grew out of this fall of the Berlin Wall. So I think that looking back today, we can certainly say it was a very positive historical experience.
How much longer did you stay in Germany following the fall of the wall? And would you contrast in any way what it was like when you arrived to mm-hmm. what it was like when you left?
I stayed until 1990, the summer of 1990, and I've been back to Germany many times after that mm-hmm. and to Austria. There were big changes, immediate changes in the economy, immediate changes in the politics, of course, in the international scope of the politics. Germany was at the center of the Cold War, and the fall of the Berlin Wall started to cool that Cold War significantly. And so you could tell just by the tenor of the atmosphere that things were much more peaceful. There were still many problems to overcome, but there was a productive energy working on these problems and a great deal of optimism at that time as well.
The fall of the wall, can you draw a direct line from there to the end of the Soviet Union? Was it the first domino or one of the first dominoes to fall toward the end of the Soviet Union?
I think so. I think, of course, that movement had started in the mid-80s
mm-hmm.
when Gorbachev announced Glasnost and Perestroika. There was already kind of a softening of that Iron Curtain. But the fall of the Berlin Wall certainly was the big step in that direction. Of course, any opening that a communist government allows sheds light on the situation there, and that light demonstrates the changes that need to be made. When the East Germans started to travel to the West, they saw what was happening there. They saw the freedoms. They saw not only that, they also saw the material
mm-hmm.
wealth that was there that they had been denied forever by their country. And once they saw that, you know, others in the East saw that too, and you saw the dominoes starting to fall as you went further east.
Have you been to Berlin since the fall of the wall? Are there still indications of East and West? I mean, this used to be here, those sorts of things?
Well, I know that for sure.
Yeah.
when I walk through Berlin, and I go back to Berlin frequently, especially with students in our summer programs, I can walk through Berlin and I can see where the wall used to be. I can
mm-hmm.
see, I know immediately when we're in East Berlin as opposed to in West Berlin. But our students don't know that. Our students can't see it unless I point it out to them and I say, hey, look at this building here. Look at the style of the architecture. This is obvious Soviet style architecture here compared to the Western style over here. I think a normal young person walking through Berlin today doesn't even see those things.
Yeah. Dr. Fred Janaga, Associate Professor of German and Chair of the German Department here at Hillsdale College. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow with the Heritage Foundation, about his new book, co-authored with John Fund, Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. For all things Hillsdale, if you're a friend of the college, an alumnus, or a friend of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Hans von Spakovsky. He is Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative at the Heritage Foundation, involved in the election process for three decades. If you have questions about elections anywhere, he is the man to ask, along with his co-author on the new book, John Fund, who is a national affairs columnist for National Review. That book is Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. Hans, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to start with the contrast of visions that you lay out in, I believe, the very first chapter in Our Broken Elections. I'll try to summarize. You tell me if I'm right, wrong, or need to be changed. Essentially, the vision for most Democrats is that everyone who wants to vote, votes. And the vision for most Republicans would be that every vote cast is a legal vote cast. Is that about right?
No, that's it exactly. I mean, the two major goals in elections should be, and actually voters agree with it, both access and security. In other words, yeah, you want to make sure everybody who's eligible is able to vote, but you also want to secure their vote so it's not, you know, stolen or voided because of fraud or errors and omission. But the folks on liberals on the left, they don't believe in those dual goals. All they want is access. And that means they don't care if people, for example, are not U.S. citizens and shouldn't be voting. They want everyone to vote no matter what.
Hans, there was so much made around the 2020 election about the election laws being changed in a number of ways by judges,
right,
by local officials. I mean, it happened in so many different ways. What's to stop those same officials from doing the same thing all over again in future elections?
One of the recommendations we make in the book is that states change their laws to give, for example, state legislatures and the average citizen the ability to go to court and sue any executive branch official or others who basically say, well, we're not going to abide by the law in this state with regard to a particular issue. I mean, a good example of this is many states, and this is smart, require a witness signature on absentee ballots. And if a election official, if that's the law in your state, an election official suddenly decides, well, you know, we're just not going to enforce that. We're going to accept and count absentee ballots come in without a witness signature. State legislators who passed the law and the average citizen ought to be able to sue that election official to force him to comply with state law.
And we even have states, Hans, who are complying with existing federal voting laws when it comes to, say, the voter rolls, who are then accused of enacting Jim Crow policies in their states when all they are doing is simply complying with what federal law insists that they do.
No, that's exactly right. And it's really odd and it's really bizarre. I mean, one of the things that the left has been pushing for is for states to basically not maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls. You know, anytime a state tries to remove people who have died or moved out of state, they almost inevitably get sued by liberal advocacy organizations, despite the fact that under the National Voter Registration Act, federal law, you know, signed by Bill Clinton in 1993, it requires states to maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls, because if you don't, it can cause all kinds of problems.
Hans von Spakovsky with us. Our Broken Elections is the book, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. There's a section in the book, and you, our listeners likely may have heard this, as we talk about voter fraud and election fraud, there's a talking point that even President Trump's Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Fraud could not find any evidence of it. And that has been echoed in many stories about the Advisory Commission. What do those reports get wrong, Hans? Because you were on the panel. You can tell us.
Yeah. Well, that shows you the real bias of the mainstream media. In 2017, the president did appoint a Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. And its whole point was to study our election system across the country, try to figure out how much of a problem we have, figure out what the vulnerabilities are, and then simply make recommendations to Congress and the president on how to fix them. When he appointed this commission, the left went crazy. They said, oh, this was intended to suppress votes, even though commissions have no executive authority. And they filed, if you can believe this, over a dozen lawsuits to prevent this presidential commission from operating. Plus, you had state election officials all over the country saying, we won't cooperate. We won't provide any information. We won't provide any data. Because one of the things the commissions wanted to do was get the statewide voter registration list from each state and then compare the data to find people who might be dead but still on the rolls, to find people who are registered in more than one state and potentially voting in more than one state. Anyway, the commission never actually got to operate. We were unable to do any of the research because of the lawsuits, because of the states refusing to cooperate, and so the president unfortunately terminated the commission after just a couple of months before it had done any kind of research or any kind of work. And yet that is pointed to by the media saying, oh, they didn't find any fraud. Well, that's because we were never given the opportunity to do so.
Hans, let's discuss absentee ballots, which are becoming more and more prevalent. No excuse absentee ballots. Voting by mail. Is there a difference in the integrity between those two, voting by mail and the widespread use of no-excuse absentee ballots? And also, if you can connect in here, how this Democrat idea of vote harvesting works with both of those concepts?
Sure. Absentee or mail-in ballots are much more insecure than when you vote in a polling place. And the reason is very straightforward. They're the only kind of ballots that are voted outside the supervision of election officials and outside the observation of poll watchers. That makes them susceptible to fraud. It makes voters susceptible to coercion and pressure in their homes. You know, you can't have a candidate standing in a polling place telling you, hey, you should be voting for me, because that's illegal. But when people are voting at home with absentee ballots, there's nothing to prevent candidates and campaign staffers and political guns for hire from showing up at their front doors to pressure them to vote a particular way. And what makes this worse is that some states allow what the left likes to call vote harvesting, because it sounds, you know, beneficial, what I call vote trafficking. In about half of the states, California is probably one of the worst. Well, look, in every state, if you vote with an absentee ballot, you can mail it back. Of course, then you're risking the Postal Service not delivering it on time, which is a big risk. Or you can deliver it yourself, or a member of your family can deliver it for you, or in most places, a designated caregiver. Unfortunately, in half the states, including California, they allow anybody, any stranger, to show up at a voter's door to offer to pick up the ballot. So what that means, again, is that you're giving candidates, campaign staffers, party activists, and political consultants the ability to get into the, show up at your door to say, hey, we'll deliver your ballot for you. They all have a stake in the outcome of the election, and you're putting something valuable into their hands, a ballot.
Lots more to talk about with Hans von Spakovsky, co-author of a new book, Our Broken Elections. We'll do that next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Reading Garden of Lights is taking place November 19th through December 31st at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens by the Sundial Bridge, featuring over 1 million lights, plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more. Presented by Mercy Medical Center Reading. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
At the Wagner Law Group, Their goal as a fire victims law firm is to advocate for those who have been victimized by Pacific Gas and Electric Company's negligence. The Wagner Law Group has been rated the number one fire attorney group in Northern California and has low contingency fees. So, if you or your loved ones have been affected by the Dixie or Zog fires, contact the Wagner Law Group today. Call 833-200-7111. That's 833-200-7111. Fall savings are underway at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Eureka Way and Market Street in downtown Reading. Maximize your car wash savings with car washes starting at only $9. A clean car is essential to the value and even safety of a vehicle. And at Quick and Clean Car Wash, they have a variety of car wash packages to choose from. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Eureka Way and Market Street next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Quick and clean.
Hey, Northern California, this is Nigel Skeet. Join me and my friends every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. with the California Adventure District radio show, where we talk about all the amazing adventures to be had in our area, from climbing Mount Shasta, hiking the trails, kayaking, overlanding, and camping with Bigfoot. We have it all. California Adventure District. Less people, more adventure. Listen Saturday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m. See you then.
Hi. This is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Reading Garden of Lights is taking place November 19th through December 31st at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens by the Sundial Bridge, featuring over 1 million lights, plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more. Presented by Mercy Medical Center Reading. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To get an email every time there's a new episode of the program, head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation about his brand new book, Our Broken Elections, co-authored with John Fund. We have to spend a minute or two at least on H.R. 1, which you spend an entire chapter on, in Our Broken Elections. Yeah. This is what the Democrats call the For the People Act. And I know there's been extensive coverage, even on the right, by people like you, about what's in this bill. I still don't think people understand. It codifies so many of the quote-unquote emergency changes from 2020. It guts all state voter ID laws, makes them illegal. There are two things in here that even I was somewhat surprised to realize. One is the way it handles redistricting for states across the country and changes and mandates changes to the way states do their redrawing of maps every 10 years. And the requirement that states now count illegal aliens in their population count when it comes to congressional districts. Both those things are in H.R. 1, correct?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's one that just... That bill was a 900-page monstrosity, probably the worst bill I think I've seen in all my years in Washington. It was basically a complete federal takeover of the running of our elections, which have been run by the states since our founding, and it puts in all kinds of bad things. On redistricting, the Constitution gives legislatures the power to do redistricting, to draw the new boundary lines for congressional and state legislative districts. This bill would take that away from state legislatures and give it to so-called independent commissions. Now, that may sound great, but if you actually look at the history of independent commissions in places like California, they draw lines in California, for example, more partisan than those drawn by the state legislature. And the big thing is, look, if the voters of a particular state, if they want to make that decision, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But this mandate is for all the states, and it brings less accountability into the redistricting process. Why? Because, look, if a state legislator draws lines that you don't like as a voter, guess what? You can try to vote them out of office. But with these independent commissions whose members are appointed, there's nothing you can do mm-hmm. if you don't like the way they act. And by the way, they put in all kinds of provisions, for example, setting up a racial gender quota system
mm-hmm.
for appointments to these commissions.
Ranked choice voting, Hans. We saw this perhaps most prominently in the New York City mayoral election recently, although there are some states
right.
that have gone to this completely. And Democrats call this perhaps instant runoff voting, same concept. And I recall before the New York City mayoral election, these stories saying, well, we're going to see how well ranked choice voting works. And then they voted, and we saw how badly and how poorly ranked choice voting works in terms of how it's actually executed and how long you have to wait for results and other problems with ranked choice voting. Why is this so popular on the left?
I think they believe it will help them win elections in areas where they don't actually are the choice of a majority of voters. It's a very confusing process to try to explain. In fact, listen, it's so confusing that it was Jerry Brown when he was still a governor of California. Look, he's a big Democrat, but he vetoed a bill to implement ranked choice voting throughout California because he said it was too confusing for voters, and he's right about that. In essence, with ranked choice voting, if you've got 10 people running in an office for mayor, for example, for New York City, you know, normally what happens is you have the election, and if none of the candidates get over 50%, well, then you have a runoff a couple of weeks later with the two top candidates, and people have the ability to once again look at the candidates and make a choice. That doesn't happen with ranked choice voting. In fact, what the voter is supposed to do on election day is vote for all 10 candidates, but rank them. Who's your first choice? Who's your second choice? Who's your third choice? And if your first choice is, it turns out, is at the bottom of the pile, then your first choice votes get thrown out. They have a second round of counting. Your second choice now becomes your first choice. And you keep doing that until one candidate has the majority of the vote. But by that time, that candidate may be the third, fourth, fifth, sixth choice
right.
of voters. And it leads to great voter disenfranchisement because of what's called ballot exhaustion. Most people, you got 10 candidates, they're not going to rank all 10 of them.
Right.
They make rank, you know, the first three. And then if you don't rank the rest of the candidates and they get into an eighth or ninth round of voting, which happened in New York City,
mm-hmm.
guess what? Your votes, you no longer count.
Right.
You're not having any choice in the final decision.
Hans von Spakovsky, the final chapter in Our Broken Elections is how to fix the flaws in our election process. You say maintain accurate voter registration lists, voter ID laws in states. One is no counting prior to election day, and I just want to ask about the logistics on this because Americans expect results quickly, and they have more confidence in election results when we know the results the night of, the day after. Waiting weeks like we do in California just doesn't make sense. So is it possible for these election authorities to get counts accurately and quickly if they don't start counting prior to election day?
Well, look, there's pluses and minuses to that, and I understand why folks want fast results. But here's the problem. Because so many states have early voting now for weeks, if not almost a month and a half before Election Day,
yes.
if you start counting early, there's a huge risk that information is going to leak out. It either becomes public. If it becomes public, then people may be discouraged from voting if they hear that their particular candidate is losing, or if their candidate is winning, they may say, well, I don't need to go vote, he's winning. On the other hand, it may not leak publicly, but if someone inside the election office leaks that information to, for example, a losing candidate secretly, it might give that losing candidate very valuable information they can use to change their get-out-the-vote approach so they can reverse what's happening in the election. And you risk manipulating election results from doing it. That's the big risk. You have to count that against the fact that, yeah, we want fast results. You know, which is the greater potential problem there?
One final question for Hans von Spakovsky. The title of the book is How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. One of the bigger changes is early voting, as you mentioned. Different states have different thresholds about when voters can start voting. 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks out sometimes. Is that perhaps the most significant way that the left has changed the way we vote? And is it a problem in your mind that we are not all voting with the same information? Someone who votes 6 weeks before Election Day is not voting with the same information than someone who votes on Election Day.
Yeah, I think that is one of the biggest problems. And I know voters think, well, this is really convenient, and they like it. But they need to think about the fact that if we have an October surprise, and it affects your choice of a candidate, it's too late for you to change your vote. And early voting is really a problem with primary elections. And, you know, the example we give in the book is, remember, Super Tuesday of last year.
Yes.
Super Tuesday was March 14th. It was before the whole country shut down. More than a dozen states had primary elections. People voted in those primary elections, but many voted early. And what happened 1 and 2 days before Super Tuesday? Two of the candidates in the Democratic presidential primary, Senator Klobuchar and the former mayor, Pete Buttigieg, they dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
But because of early voting, literally hundreds of thousands of people had wasted their vote by casting ballots for these two candidates early who were not in the election on Election Day. And so you risk disenfranchising yourself, particularly when it comes to primary elections, if you vote early.
John Fund is the co-author, along with our guest Hans von Spakovsky. He's a senior legal fellow and manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative at the Heritage Foundation. And the brand new book is Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. Hans, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Lorraine Murphy from Hillsdale's English Department returns for her series on great novels in the realist tradition as we talk Honoré de Balzac. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Greetings to my fellow veterans. This is Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of Veterans Affairs for the state of California. I'm a Korean vet, and it's my honor to serve in the U.S. Army as a new immigrant to this great country. Thank you for your service. It will not be forgotten. It should be remembered that freedom is not free. It has been secured by brave sacrifice that all members of our military and their families have given since the beginning of a great, wonderful nation. Thank you for your service.
Hi, this is Whitney from Timberline Heating and Air Conditioning. On behalf of the whole Timberline team, we wanted to take this opportunity during this special time of year as we gather to spend time with our family and friends. It is also a time to remember all of our veterans and those currently serving our country. So we join with KCNR for Operation Holiday Salute, sending peace, hope, and happiness this holiday season to all our veterans and service members from the Timberline Heating and Air family. Happy holidays.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
This is RC with today's Cigar of the Month. Present with us is the Partagas Cortado. Wrapped in an elegant Ecuadorian Connecticut seed leaf, the bold 8-inch-long Presidente is a soft smoke. Perfect with coffee after breakfast, the Partagas Cortado reaches sublime notes of creamy, spicy, and mineral-rich deliciousness. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, 2143 Hilltop, Redding, California.
Hi, this is Dan Beans, Director of Redding Electric Utility. Now is a great time to prepare for this year's upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our facilities and to the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutters, and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming in proximity of power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You can email the show with thoughts and comments, radiohour@hillsdale.edu, radiohour@hillsdale.edu. Talking with Dr. Lorraine Murphy, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Murphy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me back, Scott.
And we continue our series. See, this is how you guarantee that you're asked back. You say, I want to do a series. And so I have to have you back.
I love it.
The series, Great Novels in the Realist Tradition. And today we talk about the writer Honoré de Balzac. Who is he? What is he famous for writing?
Well, Honoré de Balzac is commonly regarded as the founder of French literary realism. Some would say with Stendhal, though Balzac is usually accorded the precedence in that comparison. And the French 19th century is where realism really takes off and gains momentum as a coherent movement. Balzac is famous for the speed, ambition, and intensity with which he wrote scores of novels in his all-too-short life. He's also, I should note, famous for fueling that labor with thick, dark Turkish coffee that he consumed in very unhealthy quantities. And his essay on the pleasures and pains of coffee is something fun to read. Following a series of failed attempts to earn a living in almost every walk of life except writing, Balzac began to write popular fiction for periodicals because it paid. So these were potboilers, and they were melodramas in a rather fixed mold. But Balzac found soon that he had a talent for writing, and he found that he wanted to write more seriously. So, interestingly, like Cervantes, in a sense, he had a kind of an affection for romance, but a stronger bent toward realism.
Hmm.
So in the early 1830s, Balzac conceived a plan to portray all of French society in a series of novels with some overlapping characters and themes. And in the end, he completed nearly 90 separate works of fiction and left almost 50 more in draft or outline. And he did this in 20 years. He assigned himself a kind of objective, almost scientific role in this act of creation. He said he would be like a secretary taking dictation from society, that he would be like a biologist classifying social species, and that he would be like a historian compiling an accurate and comprehensive record of life in his day. He divided his novels into three main groupings, scenes of Parisian life, scenes of provincial life, scenes of private life, and this is the project that he dubbed La Comédie Humaine, or The Human Comedy. I can mention some of his best-known titles, Le Père Goriot, Eugénie Grandet, Illusion Perdue, and La Cousine Bette.
So you mentioned The Human Comedy, and you said it in French. I'm not going to do that. The Human Comedy, what is, that's probably what he's most well-known for. What's that about?
Well, it's this really interesting project that, as I mentioned, incorporates 90-some, and of course he wanted more, but 90-some finished novels into three main groupings. And some listeners may beginning to discern an analogy with Dante's Divine Comedy. And this is definitely deliberate on Balzac's part. It's a mark of his ambition, in fact, that he names his project in reference to Dante Alighieri's famous early 14th century Italian poem, which maps hell, purgatory, and heaven in a wealth of detail. And so Balzac is giving us a map of the world we know in this life, with a wealth of concrete, everyday, kind of mundane particulars. And so he's comparing his work to Dante, but he's also saying, look, it's worth writing literature that is devoted to the life that we know here. And that's an important feature at the heart of realism. Balzac may also have been drawn to the notion of comedy that Dante alludes to, which is the idea that the narrative of reality is not a tragedy, but a story of how people come together, and that there is a redemptive purpose at work in human history. But regarding this contrast with Dante, which is very important to Balzac's project, though he's focusing his works on this life, I don't think that Balzac is trying to reject or deny the reality of faith or the life of the spirit. I would say that, like many realist writers, though, he's trying to constrain his representations of faith and of the spiritual dimension of experience to a human perspective, where faith is the substance of things hoped for, if you will, and where our ideas and beliefs have to be lived out in a world of physical facts and physical limitations.
Talking with Dr. Lorraine Murphy, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale, about Honoré de Balzac. You say that Balzac took some cues from Dante, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I've read in some places the comparison between Balzac and Charles Dickens. Is that a good comparison to make?
Yes, yes. First, in terms of sheer creative energy and output. Also, in terms of the ability to create incredibly vivid characters and settings by the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the affectionate interest in all walks of life and all corners of society, including the quaint and the eccentric, the slightly outlandish and peculiar, this is a great connection between Balzac and Dickens on that feature. I would say that Dickens is a bit more of a moralist than Balzac. That is to say, he's more interested in marking a clear line between vice and virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that Dickens is much more the master of the vast, intricate, interconnected plot within a single work. But the idea that fiction should seek and represent this kind of web of connections, you find that everywhere in Dickens, that should be traced back to Balzac. Incidentally, Dostoevsky, who much admired Dickens, also admired Balzac, and made a translation of his novel, Eugénie Grandet, when he was just 21. And Henry James said that Balzac's kind of wild, imperfect genius is such a lesson to the artist as perfection itself would be powerless to give. James called him the weightiest, most monumental presence in the history of the novel.
Hmm. So how then would you talk about his influence, his legacy, who then looks back to Balzac in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, Balzac, I would say, is the first continental writer to say, let's look at life as we know it, in our own place and time, in detail. Domestic life, business life, agricultural life, high life, and portray it in our fiction. And that idea of grounding the stories we tell in the concrete particulars of the local and the specific is highly influential. Balzac puts forward the idea, and does so persuasively, that these small local worlds are significant enough, are interesting enough, tragic enough, even sometimes strange enough, to be worthy of representation in fiction. That's enormously influential. Another distinctive he contributes to the novel is the representation of setting, so to speak, as character, rather than mere backdrop.
Final question for Dr. Lorraine Murphy on Balzac. Why would you recommend people read him, and how might they approach reading him? This sounds like a big project. How do you approach that?
I would recommend starting with Père Goriot or Eugénie Grandet. And I would say that there's a certain joie de vivre in his writing, even when he's describing really rascally characters or grim settings, that if you get a taste for it, is quite infectious. And you'll find yourself reading Balzac interested in things you hadn't realized could interest you. I think that's a mark of a great writer. His sentences are sometimes long and unwieldy, but they never lack energy. His descriptive passages are uniquely powerful, so reading them you feel that you can smell and touch and taste alongside his characters, and again I would say sometimes unpleasantly so, but always in a way that's remarkably powerful. But perhaps most of all I would say read Balzac because he'll make you think about the way that things, possessions, stuff, material culture, if you will, acts and speaks in modern life. The chivalric knight, as we discussed earlier, is above such things. But Don Quixote's Sancho is not. And for the most part, neither are we above things and physical comforts. So the picture that Balzac gives us of life as a web of kind of complex, intricate, finely spun connections among persons and places and things is really uniquely vivid and worth experiencing.
Dr. Lorraine Murphy, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, part of our Great Novels in the Realist Tradition, and talking about Honoré de Balzac. Dr. Murphy, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks so much, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Fred Yanaga from Hillsdale's German department, who was in Germany November 9, 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell. Hans von Spakovsky, co-author of the new book, Our Broken Elections. And Lorraine Murphy from Hillsdale's English department, as we resume our series on great novels in the realist tradition, talking about Honoré de Balzac. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Tico Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 at 1460 AM.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Make this New Year's Eve a night to remember at the Redding Garden of Lights. Featuring two stages of live music, food trucks and bars throughout the gardens provided by Mosaic, all surrounded by a magnificent holiday light show. Tickets available at turtlebay.org.
The Backbone Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. The Backbone Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Backbone Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. 1 Samuel chapter 17.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Essis. And today we are talking about basically just people, but magically bigger people.
That would be the giants. Now, we're not talking about Andre the Giant, giants, not people who are just incredibly tall. We are talking about actual mythical creatures, legends, tales of races of tall people.
Across the world, a lot of cultures show tall people as powerful people. I believe there are two different Shinto emperors who are reported to have been more than 10 feet tall. These huge giant people, literally very tall, makes them very powerful to see. So at first sight, if your hero is encountering a giant, they can be very intimidated without even talking to or encountering physically.
So when we're talking about these mythical giants, the biggest thing about them in most legends is that they're basically people, but big. They are sometimes slower, less intelligent, but always strong.
And I've found across my different studies of giants around the world, cannibalism is something that we see a lot of, or at least eating humans in some way. You know, grind your bones for bread kind of a mantra. We see that in a couple of different giant stories around the world.
I have a hard time siding with Jack on the Jack and the Beanstalk story. What would you do if somebody invaded your house and stole your stuff?
Probably exactly the same thing.
Maybe not eat them, but, you know.
Maybe smush them.
Yes. So let's get into some examples of giant or large, intimidating, strong creatures. Of course, you have your trolls and your ogres and your orcs.
And the Urukai, which are important.
Urukai!
A lot of the references to giants are an alternate race, similar to elves and dwarves, where they are human-like, but not. They aren't exactly gods. They aren't demonic in any way. They're mostly just a different kind of people.
In Norse mythology, you have the Jotuns.
And to be clear, the Avengers mythology as well.
Of course, the frost giants from Jotunheim are very based on this race of giants in Norse mythology.
There was a carving that was dated to about the 10th century AD of, I'm not going to try to pronounce the name because I'm going to butcher it, but one of the Jotun riding a dog like a horse, might have been a wolf, and she had like reins on it, but the reins were made of snakes. It was a very interesting depiction of, because most of the time when we see giants, we don't see them using tools in that kind of a sophisticated way. It's mostly like a club and smash Harry Potter in the bathroom.
If you want to look that up, I believe the pronunciation is Hyrokin. It's Hyrokkin.
And of course, heading south to the Middle East, the Judeo-Christian history, we have the Philistines, which our opener was referencing, these gigantic warrior-type people.
Even if you aren't super familiar with the Judeo-Christian beliefs, you likely have heard the term Goliath. You've heard that and know that it references a giant, a huge human that is not easily defeated. So if we want to go down under to Australia, there is an oral tradition of a giant known as Crooked Mick.
If you're listening from the U.S., you probably know who Paul Bunyan is. Crooked Mick is like Paul Bunyan, but cooler. Not only does he like chop down stuff and shear sheep and such, but he makes great pies, apparently.
Not only are his pies good, but they are light, so light that a gust of wind can carry them away. And not only are pies getting carried away, if he kicks a crocodile...
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.